Today, our subject is a classic. It is what is the basic units of social life in Central Asia and communal life and political life, if you will, public life. What are the units that count? And I'm not going to anticipate what we're going to hear, but I just remind you that every single institution, every single international institution, all the donor agencies and so on and so on and so on, not to mention national bodies like the U.S. Department of State, for example, or you name it, they all have some assumptions or convictions about this subject. You can go into any of their literature. Go on the website to any organization and you will be able to detect very quickly how they view the social structure, the ethnic base or organizational base of social, political, and cultural life. Now, the purpose of the meeting today is to expose this subject and to suggest that it is not nearly as resolved a matter as you would think if you read any of the 10 or 15 books that have been written in the West, published in major university presses in this country in the last 5-10 years. It's an industry. The purpose of this is to ask, okay, what are the reigning assumptions? And are they right? And are there other assumptions that we should also be taking into account? I've tried to present this without putting my own hand on the scale. The purpose here is to engage you with a topic that has not really figured in among policy wonks in Washington. Just note that yesterday's Wall Street Journal carried a book review of a book entitled The Rule of the Klan. And it begins with, can you believe it? Asked Steve, a U.S. Central Command analyst, shaking his head as he recalled an incident in rural Afghanistan. Tribal elders had ended a potential conflict between families by arranging a marriage that was not intended to heal the rift. Mark Weiner, a professor at Rutgers, shared Steve's outrage when he first heard about the incident from the military analyst in 2010 because the young woman, quote, had no choice in the matter. Now, in The Rule of the Klan, Mr. Weiner has set out to anatomize the defects of kinship-based societies and so on and so on and so on. In other words, here is, you know, yesterday in the Wall Street Journal, the latest book on treating this broad subject. And so I hope it gets, whatever we agree by 7 o'clock, I hope it ends up being this subject is on your radar as an open question and maybe a more interesting one than you have thought just as your eyes glaze over reading the 10 or 15 books out there. We're going to hear first from Sean. Sean Roberts is head of development. Theory, democracy development, media and development, culture and politics, all these things fall under his program of development at the Elliott School, which he joined in 2008. Prior to that, he spent several years, he had several years as a senior fellow at Georgetown. He also spent several years in Central Asia. I remember meeting at the embassy in Kyrgyzstan where he was working on development projects. He has, in addition to, I think what is quite well known, he's doing the democracy dance in Central Asia, the formal, informal, and unintended in U.S. democracy assistance, which he published in 2008. In addition to that, there's a wonderful essay he did in our book on Xinjiang, which is really a kind of a classic. Sean is as good as they come in terms of serious focus on this region. We're then going to... are you going to... go now? Okay, then we, following our deep tradition, we don't, ladies, not first here.
That's what I wanted.
Nicholas Norling is a research fellow at the Central Asia Caucasus Institute, Silk Road Studies Program, is a PhD candidate here at Johns Hopkins, working with Bruce Farrow, who is here somewhere. And he has been associated with the Institute for a good while. He was former managing editor of our China and Eurasia Forum quarterly. And he is writing on almost exactly the topic that we're addressing today, and has some interesting, very important, I think, things to report. Then we're going to hear from our friend Ms. Limonova, who is, as you know, the Uzbek broadcaster. She is the voice of America for people in Uzbekistan, because she has a weekly program which everyone there knows about, and it's gone on for, my goodness, since the beginning of radio, and covers the United States there. But she has a good background in journalism and mass communication. She studied at the Foreign Language University, World Language University in Tashkent, went off to India to pursue her studies, and then came here as a Muskie Fellow. So, since you are in the position of describing, in a sense, shooting images back to them of themselves, thought your comments would be very relevant. We have a wonderful audience, so you'll all have a chance to pitch in. Sean, you're on.
Well, first of all, let me preface this by noting also that I'm a cultural anthropologist by training. And well, earlier this week, we had a policy conference at George Washington University on Central Asia. And I found it very interesting that all kinds of policymakers want more anthropological research, which is probably a good thing. And at the same time, anthropologists are notoriously very shy about getting into policy issues. But this is a topic, I think, that really needs an anthropological perspective, in part because the origins of kind of the tribal idea, really anthropologists are to blame for that. That's something that came out of the anthropological literature early on, but at the same time, anthropological perspectives today are very different about this type of thing. Most anthropologists today talk about group identity being multiple and being expressed situationally. So in other words, different people identify with lots of different groups and they express those identities in different situations differently. Now in Central Asia, I think you'd say the tendency for people to identify with different groups depended upon situation historically created confusion for Russian colonial officials and later Soviet officials and scholars as well when they sought to define nationality. Most of you are probably aware of the significant literature that talks about Central Asians not really having nations until the Soviet Union was formed. And I think that in part comes out of the fact that people were encountering different people and asking them, who are you? What group do you belong to? And in different situations, you would answer quite differently. I think this, you know, the fact that people answer that question differently or answered that question differently in the turn of this 19th, 20th century, that doesn't mean that people who later became defined as members of the Uzbek, Kazakh, or Uyghur nations did not perceive of themselves as belonging to common national groups. But that was maybe just one of many groups that they felt they belonged to. I would suggest that group identity in Central Asia is not that different than anywhere else in this respect. I, for example, identify as an American vis-a-vis people from other countries, but inside the U.S., I frequently identify myself as being from Buffalo, New York, hence a Buffalonian, or as being an Irish American. Furthermore, others, the state included, identify me as a white male, And all of these identities are a part of me and influence my political perspectives and my interactions with those of other groups within our society. But none of them determine those perspectives and interactions exclusively. I would suggest that for Central Asians, the same sort of multiple group identities are at play in their political, social, and economic behavior. The primary difference is that the categories of group identity differ to various degrees, not only between the U.S. and Central Asia, but even between each Central Asian country. What I believe is misleading about much of the literature about the social bases of politics in Central Asia is that it frequently reifies group identities as both consistent and similar across countries. Often we see work that refers to clans or tribes within the political elites of all of the countries as if these clans and tribes determine the majority of political motivations in each country in a similar way. I do believe it's important to note several cultural phenomena in Central Asia that shape the social bases of politics in the region, but these phenomena play different roles at different times in political life and are difficult to predict. For example, there is a real cleavage between those groups which once lived a nomadic lifestyle and those which have long been settled populations. Former nomadic groups like the Kazakhs, Kyrgyz, and Turkmen maintain very strong kin-based social networks and have at least some allegiance to the memory of past group allegiances, usually referred to by outsiders as tribes or clans, that once maybe helped to form their group herding behaviors and political alliances, but now have very different meanings. Long settled in primarily agricultural groups like the Uzbeks, Uyghurs, and many of the Tajiks, on the other hand, tend to have stronger localized identities defined by their neighborhood or mahalla, their town, oasis, or city of residence. In today's context, I would argue that these identities do play important roles in Central Asian politics, but I also would warn against using them as absolute concepts that define the politics of any given country. These identities are one of many allegiances people employ in their daily lives in the region and influence different people differently. Furthermore, these group identities and others to which people feel they belong are constantly in flux, changing in characteristics and in strength. Is this really much different than in the United States? For example, when I am walking around Washington, D.C., and I see somebody wearing a Buffalo Sabres hat, it's our hockey team, I tend to engage that person on our shared interests without having met them before. In the work environment, ties like that can help in various ways, and they can also lead to shared values, interests, and political ties. But the fact that somebody is from Buffalo is not going to mean that I will necessarily support them politically. It would be appealing to me to think, oh, the President of the United States is a Buffalonian too. But that would not necessarily mean that I would vote for him or her. I think people act very similarly in Central Asia, but what defines their various group ties may include such groups as former nomadic unions, oases to which their family has long been associated with, neighborhoods, etc. I also think there may be reasons to suggest that in Central Asia, these allegiances can be more salient than in the United States. But this does not relate to the characteristics of identity in Central Asia, but to the nature of politics in the region. In other words, it's not that being from the Kazakh Middle Jews creates a more primordial attachment than being a Buffalonian. Rather, it's the nature of politics in Kazakhstan and the U.S.
The hockey players all come from the East.
That's true. Who's coming to course? One city, in fact, yeah. But what it does mean is that the nature of politics in Kazakhstan and the U.S. respectively may create stronger political groups based in Kazakh identities. In other words, in Central Asia, patron-client relations are more widespread in the political and economic life than in the U.S. And I should note as a caveat, actually, that they're quite pronounced in Buffalo, New York. But it's a matter of degrees. And where you have a lot of patronage in politics, these identities are going to play a much stronger role. The patron-client relationships in Central Asia are not only formed through cultural groups like ethnicity, some sort of tribal identity, or shared region of residence. While these factors can play a role in the formulation of patronage, it is just as often related to such issues as going to school together, the notorious Odnoklassniki connection, having shared economic interests, or immediate familial ties through marriage. When one looks at elite politics in Central Asia, therefore, one can understand why clan analysis has become such a pronounced phenomenon among those writing on politics. But the nature of these so-called clans is varied and formed through a variety of relations. If we look at Kazakhstan, for example, President Nazarbayev's inner circle has many non-Kazakhs who have no relationship to the alleged Juzes that some suggest govern Kazakhstan's politics. How would one characterize the Juzes of people like Mashkevich, a Jewish businessman from Kyrgyzstan, or the late Vladimir Kim, the Kazakhstani-Korean who ran Kazakhmys? These people have been incredibly important to Kazakhstan's politics, and they have acted through systems of patronage that seem to characterize the usual clan analysis of Central Asian politics, but they are not even from indigenous Central Asian cultural groups. I believe that some of the other speakers will pick up on these themes in more depth when talking about patronage politics in the region, but I want to offer the following takeaway from my talk to the audience. All politics around the world involve social bases grounded in the multiple identities we all possess and from the very ongoing allegiances we form in life. However, these allegiances tend to be a stronger force in the politics of places where the political system has not been constructed to mitigate patronage through accountability in the establishment of political competition as a struggle over ideas rather than merely between personalities. By looking at Central Asian politics as largely determined by socio-cultural allegiances that are connected to the unique cultural experiences of the region, we obscure the fact that the real problem with which we are grappling here is related to the lack of structural restraints in the political arena regarding the power of patronage. Furthermore, since the issue at hand is really patronage and not the ways that people come to their very patron-client relationships, following people's cultural origins through various clans, tribes, or regions will inevitably lead to flawed predictions of the ways that politics play out in Central Asia. Thank you.
Sean, thank you very much. You're on. But you could, yes.
So I've been invited to speak on the topic of informal political power in Uzbekistan. Is this on? Which is also the subject of my dissertation here at SAIS. Well, this area of politics has been described as one of smoke and mirrors. And this is not an understatement. And it places significant limits on what we know and what can be known about politics in Tashkent. Now, the only theory that we have to date on this relates to the so-called Uzbek clans. And clans are often defined as identity groups sharing a common place of birth that cooperate, penetrate the state apparatus, promote their members, monopolize specific state assets, and program resources to the native regions. And during the Soviet period, politics was dominated by three power centers, Tashkent, Samarkand, and Fergana Valley, whose natives sort of took turns and alternated in power. And these are also the main entities that have been assumed to form the three main so-called clans in post-Soviet Uzbekistan. So at least two books in the English and Russian languages and at least two dozen scholarly articles have been written on this topic to date, on the presence of Uzbek clans. Now, critics of this literature are many. However, most of these have merely criticized or restated the complexity of the problem without really providing any alternative theory or evidence of their own. So it should be stated at the outset then that no shadow should fall upon those who seriously have tried to comprehend Uzbekistan's politics through the concept of clan. Having said that, I think it's worthwhile to ask why analysts have settled on such a narrow concept of loyalties as clan or even regional elite, when our actual empirical knowledge about loyalties and politics in Uzbekistan is so small, which I think most of us would admit. So we make two main, and I hope also novel points here today. The first is that clans, as we know them today at least, were invented in the perestroika era. And this in turn has narrowed our vision to kinship, which is only one subset of the full spectrum of Uzbek politics. And it's important to know this history in order to chart the course forward in research, I think. So the second related point I want to make is that birthplace and regional origin matters in politics, but for other reasons than those associated with clans. The president has sought to address this in one end, in shielding the national arena from figures with strong regional loyalties, for example, former governors. But at the same time, he remains committed to a sort of Soviet form of coalition building, which took place on the basis of region. So in support of this statement, I will provide a rough sketch of the Uzbek power elite and its characteristics. But let us start with the first point. One source of skepticism that could be levied against the relevance of clan for Uzbekistan is the rapidity with which they emerged. Now, practically no one prior to 1988 spoke about clans in Uzbekistan. Were they launched into politics as a result of scholars, political scientists, sociologists, anthropologists who went there and on the basis of empirical observations concluded that these entities conformed to the definition of clans? Or were they a product of something else? No, I will make the case that they were a product of something else, and this something else was primarily news media. Principally Pravda, but also Western news media. Now, we can say this with a degree of certainty because whatever database you examine, the Pravda archive, JSTOR, ProQuest, and others, which contain the vast majority of research and journalists conducted, you will see that journalists, Russian and Western, started speaking about clans at virtually the exact same point in time. And this was in late August and early September of 1988. Before this, the concept was not used, neither by scholars nor by journalists. Other terms were used, corruption and mafia, from 1986 and onwards, but not clans. So Western scholars adopted this concept a year later, in 1989, and you can also trace this with a great degree of precision. And from there on, it sort of snowballed to what it is today. In other words, it is highly conceivable that scholars pick this concept up in the news. Now, normally, the adoption of concepts in scholarly research would be preceded by empirical observations. In this case, however, it was not. And Western news media, in turn, are unlikely to have placed much weight on what it really meant beyond that of selling newspapers. And from there on, it has sort of narrowed our thinking about Uzbekistan's politics to one set of loyalties, and that is clan and kinship. So I think it's time to backtrack a bit and not settle for one concept, be it clan, oligarchs, regional elite, or any other, before we have firmer ground to stand on. So let me therefore move on to my second point, which is the characteristics of the Uzbek power elite. I can only provide a rough sketch here in the few minutes I have at my disposal. The power elite that I'm referring to is based on roughly 140 national level officials and 70 governors whose region of origin, career patterns, appointments, and family ties that I've examined in my dissertation. And this examination spans the entire post-independence era and includes all major political and economic structures, the presidential apparatus, the National Security Service, four cabinets, the judiciary, state enterprises, and others. So region of origin is a place to start. Now, is the dominance of Tashkent, Samarkand, and Fergana Valley still visible in Uzbekistan? Of the 140 or so national level officials that I've examined since independence, roughly two-thirds hail from Samarkand and Tashkent to Samarkand. And, and those are two of Uzbekistan's 11 provinces. In fact, roughly half of the 140 are natives of Tashkent. But there was a point in the mid-2000s when Karimov brought in figures from across the country into government, but this trend was a very short duration, and the situation reverted around 2008-2009 to the situation we see today, with a clear dominance of Tashkent and Samarkand natives. For example, the in the cabinet today, no minister hails from Fergana Valley, which was a historical power center. So one can say that they have been, well, not excluded, but Fergana Valley has been a marginal force since independence. And the only Fergana native today in the position of political power is the general prosecutor, Rashid Kadyrov. So, and this dominance of Tashkent and Samarkand natives is particularly palpable in those structures wielding most political power, the presidential apparatus and the National Security Service. Even if the head of the National Security Service hails from Surkhandarya. As we move out from these, this hegemony becomes less pronounced, even if it's still significant. And for example, in the four cabinets that I've examined, the only 53 ministers, 35 hail from Tashkent or Samarkand, and only four from Fergana Valley. Moving further out to major state enterprises, this dominance is still visible, but less so. And in the structures of lesser importance, state committees, agencies, and others, people tend, or key figures tend to come from a diverse set of regions. So, in other words, birthplace matters, and this is manifested in sort of a pyramid-shaped structure where the most important offices tend to be reserved for natives of Tashkent and Samarkand. Most importantly, this may be interpreted as evidence of tightly organized Tashkent and Samarkand clans. However, the devil here, I think, is in the details. The natives of Tashkent and Samarkand, and to a lesser extent other provinces, all these intermingle in these organs. There is virtually no evidence that territorially based clans monopolize specific institutions, as has been asserted. There is also an array of tools used in the competition for political power among insiders, compromise, political pressure, cultural favors, etc. But this, I think, has a very weak territorial basis today. I think it's more related to professional ties and adapt to sort of informal networks that cut across region of origin. Hence, we cannot really speak about regional elite or clan today, I think. Nor is there any evidence that these two regions, Tashkent and Samarkand, are favoring the distribution of resources. If anything, the most underrepresented regions in Uzbekistan, for example, Fergana Valley, are receiving more investments per capita in education or more general measurements, fixed capital, than most other regions. In other words, among the major assumptions about the plans that they form government portfolios, that they concentrate wealth in their home provinces, or that the president has included all major clans in some form of balance or concert, really holds. Having said that, regional loyalties have been a problem, and this is evident in Karimov's policy of barring former governors from national political structures. But during the Soviet period, the top national offices were filled with figures who had served as the first secretaries of the provinces. And this was a source of regional loyalty, since they spoke in their former co-workers and friends into national offices. Now, Karimov has completely reversed this policy, and I don't think this has really been acknowledged. The former national level officials are appointed downstream to the provinces, but virtually none, with the exception of the Prime Minister, Shavkat Mirziyoyev, have been promoted upstream to ministerial or similar positions after having served as governors. So this points to that localism or regionalism, which were essentially a function of Soviet policy, is a problem that the president has made a determined effort to address. But if the president has sought to address this problem of regional loyalties, why then is politics dominated by two regions? Well, I think socioeconomic factors is a very important factor in this, but I also think there's only part of the explanation. A full answer, I think, would have to acknowledge But the Tashkent, Samarkand, Germany is a remnant of the Soviet system of coalition building. Now, with the exception of a few years during Gorbachev and the early starting period, politics always took the form of two of the three power centers sort of dominating the third. This was expressed in the Fergana Tashkent collusion from the post-World War II period and a Samarkand Fergana Valley collusion from the mid-1960s to 1983. So whenever power was distributed equally, for example during the Gorbachev era, it led to political instability, bickering, and rapid power shifts among them. And Karimov was a product of this failing system under Gorbachev, and he in all likelihood reverted to the system that worked well in the pre-Gorbachev era. And I think we're seeing this today, which is why natives of Fergana Valley are a quite marginal force. So in conclusion then, Karimov has attacked one of the major sources of regionalism in Uzbekistan by reversing the Soviet policy of appointing former province first secretaries to the top national offices. However, the system of coalition building, including natives from two of the three power centers, has been retained. And this, however, is much more about top-down power distribution than bottom-up clans or regional elites, per se. So, and I don't think the concept of a clan captures this. In fact, I don't think any concept captures this, since this form of politics arose under very specific circumstances. And on that basis, perhaps we should avoid any concept, at least until we have firmer knowledge about how our politics in Uzbekistan works. And I think the failure to heed this adage of empirical knowledge is, I think, what went wrong in 1988 and 1989, when clans were conceived. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're on.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me to this discussion. It's a pleasure to be here, to be talking to all of you. My job is usually to report news and to listen to everybody and to get everybody's views. But I do get to hear a lot of interesting things that I don't always report about. I'm here to share my own insights and I have to make a couple of disclaimers. One is that I'm not talking on behalf of the Voice of America. These are really my own views based on my reporting and personal observations. And the second disclaimer I would make is, as a Central Asian, that I do not belong to any clans or informal groups or any kind of sort of powerful circles. I do come from Tashkent region, which produced a couple of pretty strong first secretaries of the Communist Party in the 80s. I grew up in a village called Kushkurdan in Bostanlik region. It's on the border with Kazakhstan. And it was a collective farm. It was kolkhoz called Leningrad. And I grew up in the 80s. So the man who was in charge of our kolkhoz was this guy whose name was Ilhom Akia, who was a local lord, essentially. He was our don, he was our father, who everybody went to if they wanted to get their problems solved. Despite the fact that these were Soviet times, and despite the fact that we would all think that the Communist Party was in charge, he was the guy in charge of that, 20,000 plus population of that time. And, people would go, fathers would go when their sons got into trouble, especially with law, and or women whose husbands were abusing them, or a parent whose ambitious kid wanted to study in Moscow or in some other elite education centers, who really needed some good recommendations from up high, this guy would help them. This guy was our personal connection to the world. And this were in 1980s, and he had two wives. This was obviously illegal, but he had two households next to each other, and he had 15 children. So I think this is something that I'm sure many Central Asians could relate to, whether you come from Shymkent, Kazakhstan, or Astrakhan, Tajikistan, or the part of Kyrgyzstan, or Turkmenistan. You did have these very powerful local leaders who made things happen. And again, the lines between what was formal and informal and sometimes what was criminal were really blurry. So when I think of clans and informal groups, I always go back to those memories. And of course, a lot of Central Asians will tell you that those things are still happening. People, the first person people go to when they get into trouble are the local leaders. And, you know, sometimes they happen to be the chiefs of mahalas, for example, in Uzbekistan now. Or if you live in the city, there's obviously somebody who's the most powerful person in your, you know, in your apartment building or in your neighborhood that you go to. So this brings me to a question. What is a clan? I think we have to really, you know, come up with a definition of it. Are we talking about the most influential groups of people? What keeps them together? What kind of interests do they have? And are they together because of their family ties or because of common interests? And these common interests could be anything. It doesn't have to be something, you know, familial. And to me, the main question here is, what are their interests? I'm sure you will remember the last time we really heard something about clans that have a political importance was in Kyrgyzstan in 2010 when Kurmanbek Bakiyev lost the presidency and he fled to his hometown. And obviously his clan was then blamed for trying to destabilize the country. The notion of clans, the notion that the clans are the basis of politics, economy, and you know that they form this hierarchy of power in Central Asian society, is a popular one, and it's a very persistent one, and it also dates back to at least to the rise of the study of the region, I think. I know we don't have much literature on this, but I think if you go back and read some of the writings of the Soviet anthropologists, sociologists, and historians in 1920s and 30s, you know, they talk about Central Asians as these backward people, sort of tribal, and that they're clan-based. Some scientists call it Orientalism, this ethnocentric vision of Central Asia. Much of Russian and I think Soviet scholarship of the region, I think, reflected that attitude. And later on, I think European and U.S. scholars also picked up on that. Somehow, you know, it's always exotic to describe something that we don't know is tribal, or in kind of very simple terms, I think. So as I, you know, alluded above, I was speaking about regional affiliations, extended family networks, ethnic or religious minority communities or subgroups within a larger ethnic or religious group. I mean, the list goes on, and it's very easy to get really lost in the word. For example, in Tajikistan, do we speak about clans in terms of clans when we talk about the rivalries between Hulyabis and Leninabadis, Khojandis, or you know, Garmis? Groups that have sub-ethnic and regional identities. In Uzbekistan, we tend to hear a lot about Fergana and Khwarezm clans, even though these clans are not really politically powerful, as we know. I mean, we don't have anybody in the current makeup of the Uzbek government from those regions. So I think in some, while it may seem very easy to sort of discuss the clans in Central Asia, I think it's really important to define the term and use it precisely, you know, depending on the context. And also, I would say that it is really easy, it is wise to be to take the Socrates approach and say that we don't really know a lot. I mean, we know what we know, but there's a lot that we don't know. Nevertheless, I have some my own observations and preliminary conclusions about this. First, I would say that these informal groups are they're constantly evolving. They're not static. When I interview people, what I'm often told is that these structures, be they clans or regional elites, are constantly evolving. They're inherently unstable. One standing in them depends on how long one can maintain that power that he or she has, access to certain physical or financial resources and connections. This means that a person can be very well connected today, powerful, but it can easily lose that influence tomorrow. And we've seen that so much, not just in Uzbekistan, but in Kyrgyzstan and in Tajikistan. For example, I mean, Hakim of Bukhara region, who was in power since 1996, he was the don of Bukhara, Samuddin Huseynov, and nobody thought that this guy would ever, ever fall. He lost everything in late 2011. I mean, his two sons essentially owned Bukhara. And nobody actually even remembers about him now because things move on. You get another person and everybody wants things from him now because he's in power for another God knows how many years, and let's get the best out of him and let's get connected to him. Let's establish those personal connections with him. So secondly, I would say that access to information about these groups are also very tightly controlled. I mean, it's essentially impossible for journalists to go in and investigate. I would love to get my hands on the files that I imagine the National Security Services would have on these groups and see how much, what do they really have, what do they really control, what sector of the economy, who controls, and what kind of threat do they really pose to the state. Journalists, scholars, I think they tend to exaggerate the extent to which Central Asian societies are governed by clan and regional elites, as I've been saying. And this gap in our understanding, I think, is due in large part to the difficulty of doing field research, you know, across Central Asia. I know many scholars would love that, you know, would love access, would love the opportunity to go in and do long-term field research, but it's not always easy. And, you know, as your research illustrates, I had the pleasure of reading some of your writings on this, is that we don't really simply have enough evidence to rely on and to sort of discuss this with ease. And I think our inability to understand why certain decisions made in a way that they are made makes us sort of imagine things, you know, come up with easier explanations. Usually the reasons are really purely, I would say, money-driven when it comes to informal groups, and they're not really tied, in my view, to any family or tribes. You know, if we still have them in Central Asia. I mean, some people would argue that we have them in Turkmenistan, but I don't really buy that argument myself. Thirdly, I think no one admits that they're important in public. We almost never hear from the regional officials that something is not being resolved because of clans. Or if you talk to even Western diplomats, European and Americans, they almost never mention clans as important factors in their decision-making process or in trying to, you know, to resolve some kind of issues they have with these countries. I mean, I remember asking these questions from the officials in Pentagon, you know, especially about the NDM contracts, and none of them really mentioned them. The exception is, of course, Islam Karimov, who mentions about the importance and the role of clans in his books. When I ask questions like, who is the ruling class today in Central Asia, everybody practically answers something like, well, obviously, those who have the strongest political and financial connections. And so if we call that group a clan, then, you know, there is an understanding that this is about give and take. In many ways, it's like how Washington works. You know, I do you a favor today, and I obviously expect it at some point. And in Central Asia, you know, people think about the favors that their grandfathers did to somebody, and they sort of expect it, and things work like that. Sometimes out of that respect, because they obviously, you know, worry about their images and connections and the future, but it's really about give and take when it comes to informal groups. Fourth, I would say that these groups are very closely tied to the government. across Central Asia, I mean, there are many informal groups that work with each other to make money and to maintain the wealth and resources that they have acquired through deeply corrupt systems. They have connections in the upper echelons of the government that allow them to operate freely. And but they also do this within the parameters that the system has drawn for them. They know their limits. And, you know, they're obviously in bed with the government, and they profit. They also share the profit with their supporters up high. And you can see this pattern province by province, district by district. And some of these groups are really based on, you know, they're based on family connections, some of them, but they're not limited to the families. And there is some myth, You know, we all love these sort of... indeed, I mean, it is really important to recognize, I think, the way in which leaders sometimes, and very often, I would say, manipulate the myth of warring clans, and that they, it's really difficult, you know, to maintain power, to consolidate. For example, in Uzbekistan, everybody talks about how hard it is with Karimov to really keep the country together because there are warring clans. You know, we hear a lot about Fergana and Tashkent, Bukhar together, and Surkash, Surkhandarya and Kashkadarya together, and that, you know, that Karimov is keeping these three groups at bay. Otherwise, they would really be fighting for power in the country. I mean, the truth is, they do not run Uzbekistan. It's a fact that these regions, actually, Fergana Valley, when I say Fergana, I'm including Fergana region, Andijan, Namangan together, and then Samarkand, Bukhara, one group, and then Surkhandarya, Kashkadarya. This is where more than 60% of the Uzbekistani population live, and 75% of the GDP comes from there. So obviously, these are very important regions. And from your study, I also know that, obviously, the bureaucracy is run mainly by the people who come from these regions. And I think it is a very straightforward fact, and we should really treat that as a fact. The concept of clans has relevance, I think, but also, as I said earlier, it's exaggerated to explain the power relationships among elites. Whether in government or in the underground economy, power is usually, I think, determined by one's relationship to particular individuals rather than one's clan affiliation. While one's clan identity, I think, you play a role in the likelihood that you come into contact with an influential person, you have overlapping family networks, or you have studied together at Novoклассники, or served together in the Soviet Army, or in Raikom, Abkom at some point, or later in different, Hakimiats. But I would say that the determining factor is more opportunistic than traditional. And as with many things, I think obviously it's about money, nepotism, corruption, I would say bribery are the strategies people use to negotiate for and purchase power and influences. And I think these factors outweigh whether one is from Fergana or Khwarazm or Bukhara or Samarkand. I mean, at the same time, regional networks are very important in the sense that they create this perception of loyalty. But the true power comes down to really more personal ties. I would go further and say that if Central Asia was a clan-based society, it is no longer. I mean, everything we know about the region, basically the Soviet system in the last, I would say, 22 years have done much to dismantle that, the regional identities and clan relationships, I think. And this period also has fostered an opportunistic notion of power relationships, I think, that has more to do with one's access, again, to resources and to one's traditional identity. I hear a lot of Russian experts, and politicians especially, passionately talking about Central Asians, again, as tribal and primitive, arguing that the conflicts, whatever conflict we have in the region, might be tied to the bloodline and these customs, exotic customs. I mean, yes. I mean, Central Asians do honor their families. Everybody does, I think, around the world, at least most of the cultures. But, you know, the conflicts that occur, I think, between different factions is not based on that. I mean, it just really goes back to the financial economic resources. And finally, I mean, a short, I would say, cautionary note, labeling criminal groups as clans, I think, really oversimplifies the reality and sort of legitimizes them. I mean, it gives this excuse for the government, I think, to say that, well, we cannot resolve this issue because it's tied up to the clans. And let's call them criminal elites, let's call them criminal groups, you know, as they are. I don't think any citizen wants to hear that excuse from any government or even experts. There is so much pessimism about the region already. I mean, a lot of you know about that. And I think overemphasizing the role of clans can really provide that excuse for not doing much to actually reform these societies.
Thank you very much. It's so tempting to burst in, but I won't. The floor is open, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to actually a number of you to raise your questions, and our speakers could then pick and choose at their will. Please.
So I have a question.
Which, just 1 second, here comes a mic. And introduce yourself.
My name is Umida Hashimova. I'm representing myself. I'm from Central Asia. Nicholas, hearing your comments, one thing crossed my mind. So you said dominating powers are mainly from Tashkent, Samarkand. Have you thought about that actually best educational places, universities, traditionally are there? So I'm thinking back to education, and Navahar, you mentioned it. I mean, look at the U.S. People who govern or who are mostly power in the U.S. are people from coming good universities. So it goes back again, who are your parents, which university you went, and how kind of, what kind of kinship you developed, what kind of people you studied in the class, and that people become their power, they promote you. So I think most about that, because I went to the same university Navajo went, and I bet if I went to a diplomacy university, I would, my future would be completely different. But I didn't went to the diplomacy university by, because my parents are not the right category of people in the country. So I frankly, I mean, compare. I mean, look at the Yale University, like Stanford University. I mean, all powers coming. It's the same, basically, in Central Asia, basically the same in
with one big difference, and that is the state university systems here produce huge power bases for them, each state. But that's another matter.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
I'm Mahmoud Qasim. I've been in development game for a long time. just a historical note. In 1805, the first British mission to Afghanistan was led by Lord Mount Stuart Elphinstone. And he sized it up very quickly. Said, oh, this is like Scotland and all clans. And so, you know, the standard British rule, divided rule came in, one clan against the other, one nation against the other. Punjabis are a nation. And this has been standard practice for thousands of years. Empires come, they play divide and rule, and build up the cities, and empires collapse. And you know what's happened in Central Asia. And you will carry on, but it'll be under a sort of different guise. It'll still be there.
Further. Okay, let's invite responses.
May I respond? Yeah. I mean, I think you're correct at some point, and that's why I said that socioeconomic factors can explain this in part, especially the high presence of natives of Tashkent in government. I mean, but it can't explain the high presence of people from Samarkand, because, I mean, first, Samarkand is poorer than two of the three provinces of the Ghana Valley. So, and this, something must explain this fact, and I think it's part relates to cultural factors that no precedent in neither Central Asia or Caucasus ever, you know, discriminated against fellows from their native region. But moving on, I think, I mean, Tashkent, if you look at, I mean, you can go back to the 1940s, and from there on, virtually everyone in power in Uzbekistan have been educated in Tashkent. That's not a new phenomenon. And I know this because I've examined the education of probably 150 officials since this time. I would concede that it's a part of the explanation, but not all. And if you look at Samarkand, I mean, I think two persons out of 25 ministers or something that I examined were educated in Samarkand. If you look at parliamentarians, around 110 of 134 were educated in Tashkent. So this is really a magnet for everything. But it does not explain the presence of a few of other regions in power, I think.
Good. Thank you. Any further?
I would say, I mean, you know, the corruption is, to me, when we talk about informal groups or clans or any kind of organized groups, I mean, this is, it's really about corruption. You know, the way you get those jobs, high-level jobs. I mean, you can even get raised for those jobs.
Or networking.
Of course, yeah. Oh, you can call it networking, fine. But, you know, there is networking that chooses you based on your qualifications, and people usually do not recommend those who they don't believe that they have the ability to do that job.
So I mean, going back to loyalty.
Of course, yes. But, I mean, when you look at the makeup of the governments across Central Asia, a lot of the people who are serving are still those who are Soviet-educated, you know, who went to party schools, who have those... the generations are slowly changing. But there are young people who have been educated abroad, too, now. I think there is this tendency within the governments, they want to hire people who are well-educated. I mean, there was a time in Central Asia when you could buy everything. But now I see, you know, they want people who have the best of both worlds sometimes. And just one little note, for example, in Uzbekistan, when I hear people saying that, well, Fergana Valley is not really well represented, look at the makeup of Oliy Majlis. The parliament, actually, I mean, if I'm not mistaken, you have more and more people from Fergana, obviously because of the population too. And you have a lot of young people who are not necessarily educated in Tashkent or other places, but they really, I mean, there is a better representation, I would say, again, when it comes to regions. There is regionalism, localism, we cannot underestimate that. But I always look at it as part of corruption.
Yes, please, over here.
Whether we call it, my name is Volker Jacobi. I'm not affiliated with any organization. However we name it, it's a question, how are the resources being distributed in the society, in the state? So it's a question of a deal, so to say, deal like in a card game. I have a question to you, Niklas. Have you had a chance to look a bit more on the qualitative side of the response to the existing mechanism of power sharing or lack thereof in Uzbekistan? And where would this possibly lead us or leave us when it comes to the question, what will happen after Karimov? Will there be, in your expectation, some bigger problems coming from regions which have not been so well represented in the higher power elite or not? Thank you.
I'm not sure what you mean by the qualitative side, so to say. What did you say?
Qualitative, like the response from those who are not. Qualitative side in the sense that how do those who are not part of the higher power elite, who are not being put in certain positions by the president, how do they react on that, and how are they likely to react in the time Karimov is gone?
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, I don't think I have a good answer to that. I mean, figures from the Fergana Valley that are in positions of political power today, I mean, they're mainly represented in the political parties, for instance. And in academia, I think many are too. But how this will play out when there is a succession, I mean, I don't know. I mean, that would be not prognosis, but speculation to say anything of it. But I mean, if you look at the history of this region, or of the power shift since the 1940s, the one for the leader, the first secretary of the new Soviet period, and the presidents today have sort of come from that region, which has been sort of suppressed unexpectedly. I don't know why, and I don't know what implications that will have today. I mean, I'm not sure that the same mechanisms are still in place today. I don't think so. So I think it's very unpredictable. What I do think, I do think that the person that comes should have, broad legitimacy among all parts of the region, someone who has sort of roots and has proven to be a committed sort of nation builder, and but not have strong, or not is perceived to have strong regional loyalties.
Or an orphan.
Or an orphan, yeah. I mean, like Rustam Asimov, for instance, but many see as a potential candidate, but
I want to ask Sean, if I may. You've introduced, I think, very, very important notion about patron-client relations as an alternative way of looking at this. And I wonder if you could just take a minute and list off the top of your head a whole series of types of patron-client relationships. And again, off the top of your head, but no one will hold you to it, which ones you think are the most powerful.
In an abstract way?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, in Central Asia, I mean, I think that the situation that Nabokov talked about on the kolkhoz was a pretty extreme case of patron-client relations, you know. And I think that you see this a lot in the politics of Central Asia in terms of the way that these groups that are often called clans operate. I mean, I think that one of the issues, I'm not doing exactly what you told me to do, but I'm answering in a different way. One of the issues I wanted to get at that somebody brought up about colonialism here is one of the problems is the way that everybody's become convinced that this way of operating through patron-client relations is related to some kind of primordial identity, that it's somehow related to this clan, this Samarkand clan. Whereas it could be, you know, between two people who have nothing to do with Samarkand. In fact, the strongest patron-client relations in the governments of Central Asia are going to be up at the top level of government. And if you look, and it's very interesting, if you look at Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, and even to a certain degree Uzbekistan, the presidents all have very close associates who are not from their ethnic group. And it seems to be that, you know, those are very strong patron-client relations. And I think that one of these identities are real, and they can become patron-client relations, but lots of things can. And it's this idea that it's culturally bound that really, I think, obscures the power relationship that's happened.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I wanted to follow up on this, Fred.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Sam Hancock of Emerald Planet, Emerald Planet TV. And this is Ashan and Navahor. Looking at the current, not just looking at the past, but for now and the future, looking at how to work with these societies across Central Asia, what would be your suggestion? Is it to work with the universities, the stronger universities within these countries, within the ministries, or is there some other methodology that cuts across all this clan and localism that you have in each of these?
And I don't think you should worry about working with, you know, local communities just because there's patron-client relationships, because the universities are strife with corruption and patron-client relationships and bribery, and the ministries are as well, and the villages are. So I don't think that I think that, you know, the question you have to ask yourself is what you're looking at strategically if you want to work with a younger generation to have them thinking about things differently. You know, obviously, some people who are trying to do development projects in Central Asia have to work with ministries because the type of goals they have are immediate. But I think that may result in some brief policy changes, but don't result in long-term changes in terms of the way the system works.
I would say that, you know, long-term, I would invest in education. We cannot do enough in that sector. I mean, trainings, workshops, anything. Access is very important. You know, you want to have access to the country, which means that you need to work. You need to have, in short term, I was just going to say that get some really good contact with the government. and the key ministries that you will deal with. And any kind of opportunity is a good opportunity in Central Asia. There is no small or big opportunity. So access, investing in education, and developing good relationships with the government.
Yes, please. To and back.
I'm Frank Giles. I'm here on my own. And I had a question. There's been an assertion being presented that the papers we're discussing in Observable in Central Asia are somehow equivalent to the networking and constituent service practices seen in the West. I wondered if the panelists, and particularly Sean, might comment on the difference that transparency might make in distinguishing Western practices from what we're discussing in Central Asia, and maybe go further to say, speculate on how transparency might be increased in Central Asia, and what the effects of increasing transparency might be in Central Asia.
Is the implication that people don't know what's going on?
My perception is that transparency is viewed as being significantly less in Central Asia.
But independent of that. I mean, let's take that for granted. But does that mean that people don't know what are the patron-client relationships and who's linked with whom?
I think there's a difference in an organization or a group. People might know or have beliefs about patron-client relationships and about economic relationships that are hidden. But if they're hidden, or if they're supposed to be hidden and are not transparent, they still cannot be tendered or monitored. Mm-hmm. Even if people have kind of a gut knowledge or a traditional knowledge or an imprecise knowledge about them. And so those practices can't be regulated or controlled or criticized as long as they're not above board.
He's talking about case.
I've worked for a long time on development projects in Central Asia, and the one thing that people locally would mention frequently as an excuse for the lack of progress that development agencies wanted to see was, well, it took the U.S. so long to do this, and, you know, we're kind of like the U.S. were in the 1930s. And every time somebody said that, I would kind of take a double take and think, well, they got a point there. That a lot of these, a lot of the things that happen in Central Asia, you know, have happened here. In fact, the first time I went to the Soviet Union, to Uzbekistan in 1989, things made a lot of sense to me because there's a lot of corruption where I'm from. And people worked through connections, and it was very much the same way. It wasn't that foreign. And so thinking about ways that countries that have combated politics that are kind of riddled with patron-client relationships, I think transparency is part of it. The other part is some sort of force of accountability, right? You know, that's the more difficult piece, but I think you're right that there needs to be first some transparency, and people are often shocked in Central Asia when something is exposed, even though they may think this type of stuff happens all the time, but when they actually hear it, and you know it's in the newspaper for whatever reason, you know maybe it's an official who somebody didn't like, and so it's all out there. It's shocking.
I wonder if you're talking about transparency or glossness. I would argue that that everyone knows what's going on. This is a region of full-time gossips. Nothing needs to be printed in the paper for people to know about it. But what you're talking about is very important in a different sense, and that is, is this now in the realm of open discourse or not? Is that a fair, or am I distorting your meaning?
I think that's fair. I'm not a social scientist, so I don't know how to draw the
Well, I
distinguish the terms.
You know,
take a city I know very well. This isn't Buffalo, New Orleans. They people say we don't read the paper to find out what happened, but who got caught at it? Everyone knows everything, I think, in Central Asia. But you are pointing to something very important, namely that if it's not in the public realm, it can't be acted upon in a lot of normal ways.
Yeah, people are not empowered to do something about things that are under the table, even if they're known fairly well or believed in. Mm-hmm. It's not until they're in the open that they can be acted on.
Yeah, I remember talking to some Kyrgyz officials back in maybe 2002, and they were saying, you know, if we could only figure out how to get this entire gray economy legitimized, right? I mean, if all the bribes were built into people's salaries, then presumably it wouldn't, you know, the same amount of money is being spent, but it would not be all under the table, and you wouldn't have this feeling of uncertainty.
Two questions. One there, one here.
Vladimir Fedorenko, Working Institute. Thank you very much for your presentations. My question is about clans and this social identity. We're talking about to what extent they are significant right now, but what I would like to hear is about the potential of the clans. Under what circumstances they become a decisive force? As you said, the last time we heard during these clashes in Kyrgyzstan. So what is the potential of the clans then they become a salient identity under what circumstances? And I think if we look from that perspective, we will have a better understanding of this identity and how it's going to be implemented and could be implemented.
Well, let's assume that there are clans in a country like Uzbekistan. I mean, I still don't buy that. But if you assume, let's talk about then informal groups, right, who we call clans. I mean, they're constantly evolving and they're adjusting. And I think that if situation, let's say, if the leadership changes in Uzbekistan, I don't really think that they will be playing a major role in changing it, but they will adjust them to the next leadership. I mean, a lot of people ask me, well, what do you think happens after Karimov? I think, you know, somebody will come to power and this person will be somebody who will make all those informal, powerful groups sort of happy, at least for a while. And I think the groups will adjust, and they will work to build close relationships or, you know, to work with that specific leader. I don't really, I mean, in the future, I can't think of any legitimate clan playing a role. When people say clans in Central Asia, honestly, I think about sort of semi-criminal, informal groups that do have a lot of power because of the money and resources that they own.
Let me say one brief thing on that then. I mean, I think that one of the questions is what are we talking about when we talk about clans? Mm-hmm. If we're talking about criminal structures, which exist and we don't know too much about them, or are we talking about group identities that can be mobilized, right? And I kind of think any group identity can be mobilized with resources and demagogues, you know? I mean, and, you know, people have real identities. People have identities in Uzbekistan around the regions. I mean, when I studied in Uzbekistan, the men in the dormitories used to get together and have like rumbles between Surkhandarya and Andijan, and you know, and so I mean, these are identities, but you know, as I said, we have them here too. People have them everywhere. The question is, what ways they're mobilized, and I think that the way they can be mobilized is through resources, and that was the case in Kyrgyzstan. Most people suggest that when you had villages going out to protest, you know, it was largely resource-driven and kind of a patron-client relationship. The type of person that Navbahor is talking about on a kolkhoz might be from the local village government. If that person has all these people at
his or her, his disposal, it's very possible to mobilize them.
Can I just add one thing? What the question of plans, so-called plans, harbor for the future, I mean, first of all, these were invented groups, as I said. But that said, I think, I mean, it has been internalized by many, and many use it as a, many political actors use it as a political weapon. I mean, the figures that primarily use this are radical Islamists, the opposition, Western news media, and some parts of the democracy promotion community. So this has become a political actor that people speak about, and even Uzbeks, some Uzbeks have internalized it and sort of believes that this is what's happening. And even, I mean, for example, the Open Society Foundation, they sponsor this this ethnic atlas of Uzbekistan, which sort of trace our Uzbek identities, and which no Uzbeks really, you know, knew existed before. So, and this is sort of a process, I think, in nation destruction in a way. So I think the term itself can harm, although, I mean, I shouldn't overstate the significance, but I think it's damaging, I think.
Yes, please.
Kathy Cosman, U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. Thank you so much for this really interesting session. I have two questions and one quick comment. One is, I don't know the figure, but I know there's a figure out there for Russian, how much Russian governorships cost. And I'd be curious if there's any similar statistic for Central Asia, Uzbekistan, whatever. Another is whether you looked at the question of universities and how many people in the Uzbek elite were educated in Moscow and how many were educated abroad. I've been told that many students who got very good education in the West, when they go back home, are discriminated against, despite the fact that they obviously, or in many cases, have very good educations. And I think the elite likes to send their children to Oxford or wherever. And finally, my comment is that I hope a similar session could be held on Turkmenistan. Sebastian, I think, would be very well qualified to speak on that. And Farid Tufatulin made a very interesting presentation a few years ago comparing the fact that since Niyazov was an orphan, he didn't really have relatives he could name to high political office, unlike the current president who's busy naming all kinds of relatives to all kinds of important political positions. And that's having a very profound effect on the political life of the country. But I know that's a different topic, and we don't have much time. Thank you.
Well, I mean, the education of, as I said, I mean, 90% of all in power or even at lower levels were educated in Tashkent. And a few in Moscow, very few in the West. But I think that's changing now. I mean, with this new post-Soviet generation, I mean, this very moment, I think a few educated in the West are making into positions of political power. But I mean, and before that, before 1970 or 60s, I mean, this were older generation. I mean, most were engineers, like studied for agriculture specialists. And then there was this transition where we studied the whole range of possible subjects.
I think there are, now we have, in my view, three different generations of people who are in power, be they district hakims or regional hakims, and you have people in their 60s and 70s who are really, most of them are educated in places like Russia, and some of them actually in Ukraine, in places like Kiev. And then you have people who are in their 40s and 30s who have had the opportunity to, some of them study in Russia, in Uzbekistan, but also they've been trained in the West. And then you have younger generation, and a lot of them are educated in Uzbekistan, but they have also had the opportunity of, you know, in 90s, come here or go to Europe through various exchange programs. And I mean, one of the good things actually I see in the current makeup of Oli Majlisigyan, there are a lot of young people who've actually been educated abroad. I mean, it's hard to say from here what kind of difference are they making, but I do see this change happening, and I think it's worth recognizing. And the governors, a lot of people in power, by the way, the elite, of course they want to send their kids to, you know, kids abroad. And there's a lot of them send their kids to school in China, to Japan, European schools, a lot of them come here too. But selecting the governors is a very, very strategic process. I mean, this is one of the key decisions that president makes. And what is very interesting, even in not just the modern history of Uzbekistan, but if you look back, let's say, 50 years of Uzbekistan, the regional leaders were not necessarily from those regions. I mean, it was almost like a chessboard. You know, you switched them to places. I mean, Karimov was secretary of Obkom in Kashkadarya. He had nothing to do with Kashkadarya, but he was sent, and he's originally from Samarkand. And you know, Khwarazm, this forgotten part of Uzbekistan, by the way, always gets hakims from different parts of Uzbekistan, you know, hardly from there. We see the same tendency in Fergana. And I think this is a strategy. You do talk a little bit about that in your paper, I remember. It's about really like throwing them to different places so that they don't have personal sort of connections to that place that they come from. And that's something very interesting to, I think, observe.
Can I just add to that? Well, I mean, during the Gorbachev era, Gorbachev transferred these across the because to root up this corruption networks. But then Karimov reinstated this politics that was in place during Rashidov, where most governors were natives, with the exception of a few. Just to clarify.
It's hard to see about the race, so maybe ask about
it.
Let me just mention one thing on the Niyazov-Berdi Mukhamedov thing. Is I think the point I'm trying to make is, does it matter whether it's his relative or his Adnan Klasniki or his, or in Niyazov's case, you know, the inner circle had a Turkish citizen and an Israeli citizen. Is that better than Berdi Mukhamedov's brother-in-law?
I'm sorry, I think the time is out. I don't think, I want to say at the beginning, there was no intention in planning this of having a party line. There seems to be a broad area of consensus, though, among our three speakers. The differences, I think, would probably come out if we had more time to devote to it. But what I take away from this is that one should be very careful about using terms like tribe, political clans, and so on, that one should be extremely cautious and be very conscious of what you mean and what you don't mean, and probably better to say what you mean and not use these what have become cliches. It's a pity that we have not had in this discussion, more conversation about Tajikistan, for example, although we have several Tajiks in the room and experts on Tajikistan. Turkmenistan has barely been mentioned. Afghanistan is a laboratory. The book report that I, book review that I cited at the very beginning from yesterday's Wall Street Journal, is all about using these terms in Afghanistan. Does the argument that all three of you in various ways, a very sober and practical argument about caution, use of terms, and to focus instead on really quite universal patron-client relationships, is that apply equally also to Afghanistan? What's interesting about all this to me is a theme that popped up several times, and you said it at the end, this is all changing very dramatically. And, you know, just the urbanization, the growth, the fact that every capital city has more than doubled in size in recent years, and the huge concentration of talent and ability and so on, everyone meets in the capital, wherever they're from, and that is creating something, probably it's already there, we just haven't seen that, these networks of new kinds of classmates and so on, as Sean suggested. But, you know, the end of the day, what I take away from this is that the categories we apply really become important. You know, the classic example was Gorbachev himself. Gorbachev, as you've indicated, absolutely believed that he understood the deep structure of politics in Rashidov's Uzbekistan. And damn it, I'm going to break its back. And therefore, I'm going to point people from Fergana, and I'm going to point people from Khwarezm, and by golly, I'll find just the right one. Well, he came up with the perfect couple. A guy who was from Fergana, and his wife was a lineal descendant of the last emir of Hiva. And he appointed this fellow, a very, very affable guy. He's a diplomat, first-class Arabist, but unfortunately never lived there. And so this was the great, you know, counter move that was shaped entirely by his buying into this conception. And of course, poor Nishanov was a disaster. And you can say, in a way, that what happened, therefore, with the rise of Karimov was, we think of it, oh, it's a breakup of the Soviet Union, revolutionary era. This was a restoration, not a revolution. And it was precisely a revolt against the kind of sociology mongering that Gorbachev was engaged in. Now, where does that leave, you know, all of us? It seems to me the obvious, two obvious points. Sean began with one, and I think it's worth ending with it, and that is that, by golly, social sciences really do have something to say in our study of this. And it's not just a bunch of political pundits. We really got to get several levels deeper, and it hasn't happened. How many times have you heard today, what we don't know? No, I don't know. This is remarkable and welcome. I mean, this is the beginning of something new. This is that the social sciences, especially, I would submit, anthropology, sociology, and history, I'd add, really have a way of breaking into these cliches that we aren't even conscious of and enabling us to see reality. I would say that's the first, and the second is that we have to be much more conscious than we are of the way unacknowledged categories affect our own thinking and the policies which we come to. Now this is a universal problem of life. It's not something we're going to, you know, instantly walk out of here with changed beings, but it really is important. And maybe what we've heard today is that it's time to start really looking critically at not just what we think, but how we think, how we analyze, how we study the region, and to be much more self-critical than